brought to you by the Cannabis Bee Network.
Here is the Cannabis Bee News with your host, Scott Jacobs.
Hello, everyone. This is episode CBN 087, 10/31/2014. Let's roll into article number one. Is Hillary Clinton ready for marijuana 2016 push? Take it away.
Source, CNN. By Dan Merica. When Hillary Clinton graduated from Wellesley College in 1969, where the future First Lady and Secretary of State says she did not try marijuana, only 12% of Americans wanted to legalize the drug. In 45 years, however, the tide has changed for legalization. 58% of Americans now want to make consumption legal. Two states, Colorado and Washington, already have, and two more states, Oregon and Alaska, could join them by the end of the year. Despite their growth in approval, many activists see 2014 as a smaller, but important, step to their end goal. It is 2016, when voters will also have to decide who they want in the White House, that marijuana activists feel could be the real tipping point for their movement. There will certainly be even more on the ballot in 2016, said Tamer Todd, director of Marijuana Law and Policy and the Drug Policy Alliance. More voters coming to the polls means more support for marijuana reform, and in presidential election years, more voters turn out. Demographics and money are also an important consideration. Big donors who are ready to fund pro-legalization efforts are more loose with their money in presidential years, according to activists, while Democrats and young people are more likely to turn out. This means legalization activists will be better funded to reach the nearly 70% of 18 to 29-year-old Americans who support legalization. On paper, activists feel their plan will work. But it is one yet to be decided factor, who Democrats will nominate for president in 2016, that could throw a wrench into their push. Clinton is the prohibitive favorite for the Democrats' nomination, but to many in the marijuana legalization community, she is not the best messenger for their cause. She is so politically pragmatic, said Alan St. Pierre, the executive director of the National Organization for the Reform of Marijuana Laws. If she has to find herself running against a conservative Republican in 2016, I am fearful, from my own view here, that she is going to tack more to the middle. And the middle in this issue tends to tack more to the conservative side. Man with bullhorn heckles Hillary Clinton. Making a concerted push during a presidential election year means activists' goals will be directly contrasted with the Democrats' presidential standard-bearer. This happened in 2004, when more conservative voters helped tip the presidential election for President George W. Bush at the same time that 11 states had anti-gay marriage questions on the ballot. Clinton has moved towards pro-legalization, though. Earlier this year, during a town hall with CNN, she told Christiane Amanpour that she wants to wait and see how legalization goes in the states before making a national decision. At the same event, she cast some doubt on medical marijuana by questioning the amount of research done into the issue. Later in the year, Clinton labeled marijuana a gateway drug where there can't be a total absence of law enforcement. I'm a big believer in acquiring evidence, and I think we should see what kind of results we get, both from medical marijuana and from recreational marijuana, before we make any far-reaching conclusions, Clinton told KPCC in July. We need more studies. We need more evidence. And then we can proceed. This is more open, however, than in 2008 when Clinton was outright against decriminalization, a step that is less aggressive than legalization. Despite warming on the issue, Clinton's position is concerning to activists like St. Pierre because he feels they are far from solid. If reforms keep picking up, the winds in our sails are clear, he said. But if we lose one of more or all of those elections this year, cautious people around her could make the argument that this thing has peaked and you now have to get on the other side of it. St. Pierre said he also watched, laughing, as Clinton tried to personally distance herself from marijuana at the CNN town hall. Absolutely not, Clinton said when asked if she would try the drug. I didn't do it when I was young, I'm not going to start now. I will eat both of my shoes, he said, if she and Bill didn't trip their nuts off at Wellesley and Oxford. What's more, some activists spoke highly of Democrats with executive experience like Maryland Governor Martin O'Malley, who spent 8 years as mayor of Baltimore. Hillary Clinton raises funds and picks up a big check in Vegas. O'Malley, who is also entertaining a run at the presidency in 2016, supports medical marijuana and approved a Maryland law that decriminalized possession of small amounts of the drug in 2014. As a young prosecutor, I once thought that decriminalizing the possession of marijuana might undermine the public will necessary to combat drug violence and improve public safety, O'Malley said in a statement at the time. I now think that decriminalizing possession of marijuana is an acknowledgement of the low priority that our courts, our prosecutors, our police, and the vast majority of citizens already attach to this transgression of public order and public health. As for where the governor is on legalization, Liz Smith, his top political advisor, said as long as it is consistent with the goal of driving down crime, O'Malley is open to sensible drug policy. With an eye on 2016, some activists are starting to contrast that view with Clinton. I think in 2016 there is going to be a number of states with legalization initiatives on the ballot and there will be broad support, Todd said. I don't see standing behind and defending the status quo of this destructive policy as helping a candidate in the 2016 election. Clinton has come face to face with some aspects of marijuana policy on her trips to stump for Democrats across the country. While raising money in Colorado for Senator Mark Udall earlier this week, Clinton saw marijuana in her coffee. Pointing to the foam design atop Udall's latte, Clinton said, "Look at you, you got like a plant. Is that a marijuana plant?" To laughs from the baristas at Pig Drain Coffee, some who may have seen that the design looked more like a rose than marijuana, one answered jokingly, "That's exactly what it is."
Article number 2. Hemp is on its way to your car battery and many things you haven't yet thought of. Take it away.
Source, Huffington Post. By Doug Fine. The first digital age domestic hemp crop is being harvested as I write. The subtle decrease in seismic activity currently puzzling Virginia geologists can be traced to Thomas Jefferson ceasing to spin in his grave for the first time in 77 years. For a century, USDA biologists conducted taxpayer-funded hemp cultivar research for farmers, after all. They did this in a Virginia meadow that is today the Pentagon. And why wouldn't they, in support of a key crop supplying the Navy with rope and earning millions for farmers from Wisconsin to Kentucky when millions meant something? Then there was this weird quirk, Google cannabis prohibition. If the cause of the quirk is news to you, and it took a tucked-in provision in the 2014 federal farm bill to allow hemp research to restart. As I learned while researching my latest book, Hemp Bound, this longest utilized of agricultural products today defined as cannabis with less than 0.3% of psychoactive THC is offering up a genuine opportunity to provide food and energy independence for the U.S. and beyond while stimulating a multi-billion dollar agriculture-based economy. It might even lead to fewer resource wars. Just that. This is what happens when you cultivate a plant for 12 millennia. It develops a broad range of helpful properties. Want some in-the-field proof? Last week, on a suspiciously hot late September morning, I was standing in the middle of a two-acre hemp plot in Sterling, Colorado, absent-mindedly nibbling ripe, omega-balanced seeds right off the flower, while conducting an interview. I was surrounded by hemp plants taller than I. Every now and then a piercing train whistle from Warren Buffet's BNSF nearby freight line interrupted the bee chatter. Bill Billings, John Deere ball cap wearing president of the Colorado Hemp Project that had commissioned this field from 67-year-old local farmer Jim Brammer, was answering my question about how the fiber side of this harvest from a Chinese cultivar was going to be used. Supercapacitors, he said. He said it offhandedly. What struck me was the absence of braggadocio. It was like he was suggesting the crop was going to be used for livestock bedding, a profitable, if long-standing fiber app for hemp in Europe and, starting in 2015, the thoroughbred market in Kentucky. Supercapacitors are next-generation battery storage components, the kind of technology that's going to allow a solar-powered ranch like mine to charge a week's worth of energy from an hour of sunlight. Seems the ridge shape of hemp, when reduced to nano-size carbon atom sheets called graphene, causes it to outperform previously leading modes of experimental and, by the way, environmentally unfriendly energy storage at, according to a paper delivered at the 2014 meeting of the American Chemical Society, 1/1000th of the cost. Just that. Billings and the dissenters at the Boulder area tech company with which the Colorado Hemp Project is partnering for the Sterling Harvest asked me to keep the specifics out of this piece because the deal's still being finalized. But the buyer is an established player in the nano arena and its CEO told me via email, "We are interested in hemp because we believe hemp will change the way energy is created, charged, and stored." Brammer, the overalls-clad farmer who sowed this Sterling crop, told me that hemp drank half the water the previous season's GMO corn crop did. He also applied no pesticides or fertilizers to the hemp, and the dang crop in places was 10 feet tall. "I didn't put nothing but water on this field this year," he said. "And the plants were so flower dense." Canadian farms harvest an average of 800 pounds of hemp seed per acre, leading to $250 per acre profits right from the field. That's 5 times soy profits. Those 800 pounds per acre, by the way, fetch north of $20 per pound retail. That's why in this tri-cropping model I hyped vertical control of the industry by production communities. We're talking $336,000 inches revenue for a 20-acre hemp farm in Vermont. And that's just for the seed. Beyond the raw seed itself, value-added products like hemp protein juices and the Slovenian hemp clay mint toothpaste my family is plowing through at the moment just increase the earning potential for today's struggling farming communities. The Canadian industry is growing 24% per year. It's poised to pass $1 billion in revenue itself this year, its 16th in the modern era. Crew told me Canadian hemp oil and seed cake processors can't keep up with demand. This is good for American farmers. It's also good for the planet. While all this money is being made, putting small farmers back to work, hemp is cleaning monoculture-damaged soil via its famous phytor mediation qualities. And as Brammer confirmed, no harmful pesticides are being added. "None needed," says the Canadian Agriculture Department page dedicated to the plant. Hemp is already changing the playbook for the embarrassingly low 1% of Americans who farm today, down from 30% when cannabis prohibition began in 1937. Sustainability mixing with profitability, this is why it matters that Brammer was seeing what a non-GMO crop can do. Sterling, Colorado is in Logan County, a part of the state so conservative that 42% of county voters chose to secede from the rest of the state last year. "I'd seen this kind of rural local pride in Kentucky and Belgium in recent weeks as well. Hemp is off the table as a culture war issue. In the bluegrass state, it's a Kentucky heritage issue for the former world hemp industry leader. Those heady days are still in the cultural memory. Don't try to trash talk the cannabis plant in Lexington," in other words, where I attended a hemp industry meeting on the 28th floor of the Lexington Financial Center building last week. Their pinstripe suits were the norm. A Republican state senator, Paul Hornback, was in attendance, and hemp bullishness was de rigueur. The Colorado Hemp Project seeds, by the way, were scrumptious, and imported versions of it are already in your supermarket, at that $20 a pound. Hang tight. Local hemp is on its way. I can introduce you to the farmers. For now. Soon you won't need my help. I knew as I munched that I'd be looking back in a few years in awe at how fast the U.S. hemp industry has grown even from these impressive beginnings. Colorado, Vermont and Kentucky, the three most active hemp states of the 19 with hemp cultivation laws this inaugural post-farm bill season, have, combined, fewer than 2,000 acres planted this year. Both of HempBound's 2013 hemp farming heroes, Michael Bowman and Ryan Laughlin, were at it again in 14 as well. Colorado is the only state that permitted commercial cultivation this year, ahead, let us hope briefly, of federal law. For research purposes is still the law of the land. Research plots, though they may be cultivating, farmers in Kentucky have also been allowed to sell their harvest. In fact, every molecule of seed and fiber from every hemp field I visited this debut season had a buyer. That's both saying a lot and not. It's not much acreage. But it's a dang good way to look back on an industry in 20 years. Every single farmer always has had a buyer for everything she grew. Furthermore, I think we'll see an impressive 15-fold increase in hemp acreage in 2015, to 30,000 cultivated acres. More even than Canadian processor Crew's plea in HempBound for American hemp cultivators to meet the double-digit increase in demand for the seed harvest. I love seeing the Hemp Farmers Wanted page on Vermont Oil Processor American Seed and Oils website. This industry is hiring. and it is comprised of classic American go-getters. My email inbox just pinched with a CC/D note from 40-year-old Kentucky farmer and nonprofit executive Mike Lewis, an Army vet whose Growing Warriors project is providing some of the hemp fiber that will go into the paper for a coming project of mine. He can get the fiber to the pulp mill in a couple of weeks, he said to Morris Beagle, the fellow pioneering domestic hemp printing care of his Colorado Hemp Company. Think of the carbon savings when not only is the entire publishing industry tree-free, but the hemp pulp doesn't need to be shipped to or from overseas. But, hey, you might be asking, is the infrastructure in place to develop a new industry, albeit derived from a very ancient ag product that was successful from Neolithic times through 1937? All I had to do to answer that question in the Sterling hemp field was turn around. Remember those startlingly loud BNSF train whistles? Their sources were half-mile-long lines of freight cars chugging by every 20 minutes, an easy walking distance from where I stood stuffing my face with protein and magnesium. I predict that within the next two decades, today's domestic diesel-powered transportation grid including trucking will be at least partly powered by U.S.-grown hemp oil. This, I hope, will be part of a transition to a hemp graphene-based electric transportation system charged by the sun and wind, supplemented by hemp biomass power at a distributed, regional, community-owned grid system. This is safer for America than one centralized master grid. Furthermore, the fracking rigging with which the cars were loaded down this September day, a fracking industry employee at the Sterling field with me kept pointing out directional drill pipes and flex drill collars in some of the open BNSF cars. And I could see multiple active fracking rigs scarring the landscape on the drive from Denver will give way to train loads of hemp seed and fiber by the millions of tons. It's win-win. Trains and trucks powered by plentiful, domestic, carbon-friendly hemp, delivering lucrative hemp to markets worldwide. Even the hemp harvesting tractor bodies will be made from hemp fiber. If this sounds crazy to you, next time you're in a Mercedes, kick the door panel. It won't dent or budge. It's made partly of hemp fiber today. But how do we get there? What does a hemp-intensive economy look like on the ground? To answer that, we head 1,100 miles east from the Sterling Food Battery Field. I learned when I set out to kick petroleum in 2006 for an earlier book that such a big slice of the project we humans have in front of us if we want to survive involves developing regional economies, food economies, energy economies, industrial economies. Think of this as the dawn of the post-globalization era. Because of what all my research concludes is this locavore imperative, it shouldn't have surprised me that another indelible memory from the hemp harvest tour went down on the farm of a Kentucky veteran who began fighting for food security when his brother came home wounded from Afghanistan and had to apply for food stamps. This became what you might call the hemp heritage branch of the tour. On a more properly autumnal afternoon, I wound south from Lexington through hills and hollows to the Rock Castle County farm that the bearded Lewis has turned into hemp headquarters for the Growing Warriors Food Security Project, of which he is executive director. There at New Constellation Farm I found myself in the barn holding hand-broke hemp bast for the first time. Lewis and I had just processed the fiber in question. We did it care of a wooden hemp break. These are simple levered devices about the size of a horse that have been used for a few millennia to remove the plant's valuable bast long fiber after the outer bark softens in the field through a process called redding. After the bark is peeled and the bast fiber removed, the shorter herd fiber is caught in a bin underneath the machine, for use in applications like hempcrete, a building mixture comprised of hemp herd and an organic binder-like lime that insulates better than fiberglass and is all the rage in Europe and the above-referenced livestock bedding. The break we were using was a shiny new device built by Lewis farm manager Kevin Lancey based on a traditional and ubiquitous design like the 70-year-old one Kentucky hemp pioneer Craig Lee and my part Mose Putney had just discovered in the barn of a 5,000-acre antebellum hemp plantation that's today the Walnut Hall Thoroughbred Ranch. Lee and Putney had kindly invited me and my Kentucky host Josh Hendricks, founder of the Kentucky branch of the Hemp Industries Association, along on their sleuthing. A mechanized but expensive machine called a decorticator allows farmers and processors to skip the risky and time-consuming field redding stage. Without one of those doohickeys, the harvest relies on muscles, rather than electrons. But I was surprised to find that redding hemp fiber isn't that hard. I kind of expected that it would take 100 sharecroppers a month to process a pound of fiber. In fact, A play-by-play goes like this. Lift hemp brake lever. Lay handful of redded hemp stalks on the platform below. Clomp 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 with the lever. Easily pull off bark, exposing treasure of the world's strongest natural fiber therein. Add to pile. I recall that the moment the first tangly cord of that Kentucky fiber hit my hand in the growing warrior's barn, my palm enacted a sort of cinematic devil take. That's because it was soft as silk and stronger than steel. Believe me, I tried to rip it, karate chop it and stomp it. What shocked me was not that hemp's durability rep was deserved. I'd held the production line bast fiber that goes into those Mercedes door panels, but that Kentucky farmers were nailing it right out of the gate. I do a lot of reading, Lewis admitted. Still, I thought this field-breaded, hand-processed hemp had to be inferior to what the experienced big guys were doing in Europe. Nope. This bundled skein of fiber was good enough for that most ancient and demanding of hemp applications, textiles. Listen up, struggling South Carolina clothing mill communities. Later that day, a local seamstress named Stephanie Brown picked up an armful of said fiber from Lewis. "This'll be on my loom tomorrow," Brown told me proudly. And so an industry returns. Sure, we're likely to soon be talking about machine-processed hemp by the thousands of tons. That's terrific. What Lewis, Brown and crew showed me was a start, from modern year one. As Newton teaches us, launching is the hardest part. Once you do, everything is scalable. For Lewis, as important as hemp is, even more important is developing a rural locavore industry of any kind. Kentucky is lucky because our topography long ago created a network of small farms, rather than huge plantations, he told me as we strolled New Constellation's 486 acres too dedicated to hemp this year, 25 next year. Hemp is perfectly suited here for a broad range of regional industries made up of networks of independent farmer entrepreneurs. Vertical control of your industry, work for it in your own community. Then you don't have to worry so much about Wall Street's vicissitudes. Start with rural community-owned hemp processing that breeds vibrant regional economies. Add local energy through biomass gasification, hemp-based batteries to store it, drought-resistant plants, soil phytor mediation and seed oil superfood to the mix, and forget fantasy. There is no eventual actual hemp role in our future too grandiose to astound me at this point. In other words, get ready for an entire hemp market sector that will be included in the top of the hour business wraps. The reality of hemp on the ground as its first federally authorized crop in the 21st century is harvested has exceeded even my most sanguine expectations. Phew. It wasn't a mistake to have human and goat kids in the 21st century. After I milked the goats this morning, I'm off on a hike up the eponymous Funky Butte with both species, and I'm feeling more confident about my replicant's future than I have since last year's second millennial flood this decade wiped out the Funky Butte Ranch driveway again. Part of the reason for my confidence is I know that from the top of the butte I can map out the 5 acres I plan on devoting to hemp the moment full commercial legalization arrives. Call your senators, S-359 takes us beyond research cultivation and gets us all planting, the Industrial Hemp Farming Act. God bless America and God bless those hemp farmers.
Article number 3. Family Friendly. Denver International Airport plans to ban marijuana-related souvenirs. Take it away.
Source, Westworld.com. By Westworld. You can't possess pot inside Denver International Airport. You can't eat it, smoke it, grow it or give it to a friend, and soon, vendors there may not be able to sell pot-themed merchandise, either. We have started the process to restrict marijuana promotional merchandise at Denver International Airport and will be following the public hearing process to amend the airport rule to reflect that, airport spokesman Heath Montgomery told Westworld this week. That revelation comes 6 weeks after entrepreneur Ann Jordan complained that the airport was preventing her from selling pot leaf imprinted flip-flops and boxer shorts to one of the souvenir stores there. Jordan, a retired teacher who earlier this year started a business, Highline Legal Colorado, thought it was ironic that the airport allowed Colorado flag shot glasses but not her products. "I don't know where they're drawing the line," she said, adding that weed has become one of the state's best-known selling points. After Jordan complained, the airport acknowledged that it didn't have a formal policy on pot-related merchandise, but officials there said they would take up the issue. We will be discussing this and decide if such a policy is needed and whether or not we want to allow marijuana promotional products to sell in our retail program, Montgomery said at the time. And, in fact, there was at least one pot-themed item for sale at a souvenir store in Concourse A in Schmidt-October, a green t-shirt depicting a marijuana leaf with the words Exit 420 and Welcome to Colorado on it. That shirt was produced by local firm Duck Company. On Monday, Montgomery said the decision had been made. Pot merch is now kaput. We do not feel that this merchandise is in keeping with the standards for our concession program. As the gateway to Denver, Colorado, and the Rocky Mountain West, including states like Wyoming, in which marijuana is not legal, we don't want marijuana to be the first thing visitors experience when they arrive, as there is so much more to this area, Montgomery said in an email. We also do not feel that marijuana-oriented merchandise is in line with our family-friendly environment. Finally, DIA operates under both local and federal rules, and federal law does not recognize marijuana as a legal substance. While some people might suggest that the airport's current block-long display on Colorado's craft brewing industry is in the walkway between the concourse and Terminal A, and recent temporary beer-tasting garden aren't family-friendly, either. Montgomery pointed out that the distinguishing factor is that marijuana remains illegal at the federal level. Pot-themed souvenirs, however, do not. Updated, that's something that irks Duck Company co-founder Jim Bruno, whose Exit 420 shirt is for sale at DIA. It's ridiculous. How can you ban something that is legal? He asks about both marijuana and t-shirts. Bruno's company, which was founded in 1988, doesn't specialize in pot t-shirts. We try to stay on top on whatever the trend is, he says, but he feels like the market is strong for them. It's such a fun and unique thing for Colorado. It's part of Colorado's brand now. DIA plans to move ahead with its public hearing on the issue sometime in mid-November. The hearing is required because the ban on pot merchandise would involve a change to an airport rule, specifically Rule 30, Conduct of Persons Using the Airport, which covers everything from security screenings to picture taking to roller skating in the terminals not allowed, just FYI, to concessions. Oh, and it also covers pot under Section 30.16, which reads, it shall be unlawful to possess, consume, use, display, transfer, distribute, sell, transport, or grow marijuana on any property or facilities owned by Denver International Airport, including but not limited to any building, structures, terminals, parking and ground transportation facilities, roadways, land, hangars, warehouses, runways, shops, hotels, motels and administrative offices. For the purposes of this Section 30.16, the term marijuana shall mean and include all parts of the plant of the genus cannabis, whether growing or not, the seeds thereof, the resin extracted from any part of the plant, and every compound, manufacture, salt, derivative, mixture, or preparation of the plant, its seeds, or its resin, including marijuana concentrate. Marijuana does not include industrial hemp, nor does it include fiber produced from the stalks, oil, or cake made from the seeds of the plant, sterilized seed of the plant which is incapable of germination, or the weight of any other ingredient combined with marijuana to prepare topical or oral administrations, food, drink, or other product.
All right, that's all I have for this episode. Till next episode, have a good day, good night, good week. Bye-bye.